Not a chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make heaven in the middle of it. Grass make heaven in the middle. We are grass make heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. This week has been hellacious. We've had the bombings in Brussels. I mean, we've had Obama down in, Argentina and different countries in Cuba. And he made some statements down there recently that were very interesting. Basically, he was saying things like about communism and capitalism. And he was telling a very young audience down there that they shouldn't get so hung up on terms. These are his direct quotes. But let's choose from what works, the president suggested. A little bit of both approaches is necessary to balance equality and inclusion with economic viability. Dismissing debates about the differences between capitalism, communism, and socialism as merely interesting intellectual arguments, the president told town hall participants. Not to worry about all that, but just to do whatever is practical. Well, what this is all about is communitarianism. And communitarianism is a philosophy that's been used by Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and everyone in succession, even Barack Obama and so forth, to bring together, to fuse together capitalism and communism. This is something that's being promoted by your elitist, your international elitist, the ones with the ultra capital. The very beginnings of this idea you can trace back to Fabian socialism, or the Fabian Society, which was founded in England. This was a society whose goal was to bring gradually to England a socialism, and they did. They have done that. The only problem today is that they can't afford all the benefits that they've been promising the people. So that begins to be non-viable. Is socialism a viable system? When you begin to try to provide so many, assets and services to so many people from so many few working, then you're going to have big problems, and that's the problem today over there. A treasure trove of information has been put together by Nikki Rapana out of Alaska. She and her daughter Nartica put together a tremendous writing that is downloadable free. But we'll have click-offs there tonight. If you go into thesecrettruth.com, you'll find click-offs there, and you'll be able to download that and look at the communitarianism work that Nikki Rapana and her daughter Nartica have done. It's a tremendous body of information and insight into what's going on in this country today. So look at that very carefully and scrutinize and read that. A concerted effort worldwide has been going on for well over a century and a half. And basically the effort is by the world's ultra-capitalist. And what they want to do is marshal the people into much more of a communist, in this case, communitarianism. They're using that because it's an end run around capitalism. You'll notice that today there are people, all kinds of people that are saying, let's look to the Chinese model. By gosh, they've got capitalism? No, they don't have capitalism. They have state capitalism is what they have. And the military and political top dogs over there, the top leadership, are the ones that dominate the capital that exists that China has. So it's not a real free market. It is for business on certain levels. But when you get up to the higher levels in China, you're going to have to play ball with the top military and the top political leadership that has come many cases is intertwined or intermarried with that top military leadership. So that's what you're going to have to deal with in China. And China has become an economic world power and dynamo. Many of us have a hard time beginning to understand this battle between the so-called capitalist, socialist, and communist. What has been going on since the Fabian era, which is late 1880s, is that there have been a push by the wealthiest people in the world to bring about world communism. It is a method by which to focus people on a very status type of system of which they will control. The famous famous Italian Mazzini described a system in the late 1800s into the early 1900s as fascism. The description of fascism that he set out would be one where the trade guilds were in partnership with the government. Today, you'd have to say that the international corporations or your transnationals would be in partnership with the governments, but more so, they would be dominant over most governments. They're pushing all the time, whether we're talking about Davos, the World Economic Forum, or we're talking about the Bilderberg meetings, they're continually pushing public-private partnerships. These will enable most of the large corporations to access an endless line of credit through the nation states. But also, it enables these large corporations to grow larger. And that's basically what has been going on since the turn of the century into the 21st century now. All during the 20th century, you had these large concerns that began to monopolize. And actually, what we have, we don't really have a free market system as such. We have a form of crony capitalism or monopolistic capitalism. Another description would be Babylonian capitalism. It's where we have capitalism that is being dominated by some of the largest institutions. These institutions have grown so large that many are much larger enterprises than some nation states, all except for the largest of the nation states. And casting an umbrella over this whole system of rule, you could say, are the promulgation of trade agreements. There's the latest two would be the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which Obama and all of his cronies are pushing. And then you've got the Atlantic Partnership Agreement, which is more European-American. The other one is more Western Pacific Basin-oriented. But both of these trade agreements have built into them agreements between the largest of the traders and the corporations. So it's overriding, in most cases, through business law, etc., nation-state constitutions and generic law or basic, the beginnings like our U.S. Constitution. And that's what many of your freedom and your freedom fighters are and your democracy-oriented people and your patriot people are wary of. They're seeing an enlarging corporate fascist dominant dynamic develop and at the individual. Now what's being played along with this is like recently when I said earlier in this broadcast You had Obama down there in Argentina speaking to some kind of a young group, and he's saying things like, well, you know, he didn't use the word communitarianism because that's not often used. That would be too revealing to much of their insight. But he said, well, you got to sort of do what works, you know, capitalism, communism, socialism, sort of go along and do works. You know, that's basically what he was saying down in Argentina to this young group. Well, what you're having is communitarianism has been put forward as a mechanism to fuse capitalism and communism. And basically the idea, Nikki Rapana and her daughter, Nardika Frederick, up in Alaska, wrote an earth-shattering volume on communitarianism that's available. And it's up on our site tonight. So we're looking at March 26th here in Austin, Texas. And we're trying to make a difference. It's very hard sometimes because you've got so many diversions and so many people that are being interrupted by just trying to make a living and two or three jobs and trying to put, you know, a life together for their family, you know. But these concepts are being, like I said earlier about communitarianism, it was a Bill Clinton, the George W. thing. It was an old man Bush thing. It's a Obama thing, see. All of these presidents have latched on to this because they believe that that is the way. It's called the third way in many cases, okay? The one way would be capitalism, the second communism. This is called the third way, see. But it's a way to provide more power and dominance for the community over the individual. Each one of you out there, not everyone, has experienced these communitarian dynamics in the form of neighborhood associations. This is where they're becoming more prevalent across the landscape of America than any other way. They have these neighborhood associations now, and they meet, and they're dovetailing in there with the zoning and the planning people of the cities and of the entities across the country, and they're beginning to work together and so forth. And they're becoming very fierce and very dominant about what you can do with your property, see. The communitarian idea is that the community has precedent over the individual. So you can take the Bill of Rights and throw it out the window, see, when you're talking about communitarian ideals and precepts, see. This is where many of your anti, you know what I mean, Federalist would turn over in their grave. Thomas Jefferson and George Mason and those people that actually fought to have a Bill of Rights created. See, the Bill of Rights did not come along with the U.S. Constitution. The Constitution was written without a Bill of Rights, okay? And only the anti-federalists, that they got stiff-necked about it and they got their back up about it and said that we're not going to ratify the U.S. Constitution until a Bill of Rights is attached to it or amended. So the Bill of the Rights was an amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and it came at the first meeting of Congress, see. I believe it was in New York at the time that they met, the first congressional meeting. But the final states who ratified the Constitution were promised that, yes, Congress would take up the Bill of Rights, and it came down to 10 original at. Before that, there was a committee appointed, and there was 100 Bill of Rights at one time, and they whittled it down to these 10. Thank goodness we got some, you know. But without that, we don't have a republic, because the republic means that it protects the Bill of Rights and so forth, protects individuals from a very repressive, dominant government that could take your guns and do with you what they feel. That's why the gun rights issue is so paramount to our continued freedom in this country. If somebody has a gun and you don't have a gun, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to do what they say. So, and the same way is true with the government. When the government has a monopoly of force and the citizens are deprived of any right of deadly force, then you've got a totalitarian despot type of government. And that's what the real battle is. The individuals that are over on the liberal side of the gun rights issues are totally wrong about this. They don't get it. They start talking about hunting rights or something, and the Obama and them push out stuff like that and other people. But it's not about hunting rights. It's about the right to defend oneself against a repressive regime called government. And the longer governments are in existence, the more powerful that they get, the more taxation that you're seeing that they exhibit, and they become repressive and domineering. And that's actually what's happening in America today. We've got some really, really big problems, and we've got to start addressing these. That's where Trump, and I don't like his personality as such. And I believe that his ego thing, he's not mature enough to handle that yet. But he came out on this immigration issue, and it touched a lot of people's nerves. And people said, yeah, that's a problem. Obama has opened it up. And many people would say that he has used illegal executive orders to do so, and has gone out and above and in violation of our Constitution and immigration laws. So there the battle lines have been drawn. But you see now that there's a tremendous organization going on within the elites of the Republican Party to deny Trump any possibility of gaining the presidency. They don't trust him because he's not a real true insider. He's not a secret society boy. You know, he's not one of the real insiders, so they can't really trust him. And they don't know, he's a bit of a loose cannon, they feel. And he could do anything when he goes in. He's espoused certain views on 9/11, certain things about audit the Fed, like Ron Paul first put forward, that we fully supported. And they fear his presidency could come against their interest. And so they're doing everything they can. Right now, it looks like to me, after a close calculation and reading, it's going to be difficult for him to gain the majority of delegates. I think Ted Cruz is coming on strong enough to where he is gaining enough to deny Donald Trump an outright majority. And even then, if Donald Trump went to the National Convention in Cleveland, and it's going to be held in Cleveland, the Republican Convention, even if you went there with a majority, they have these rules committees and things like that that they can start changing the rules before the convention sits. They can deny certain delegates seating. You know, you have to prove that you're a legitimate delegate, and then they have to seat you, you know, and all this other stuff. And in that process, they could deny some of his legitimately elected, allocated, you could say, delegates, that he won, you know, honestly, in the primaries and caucuses. They could deny him some of the seating of some of his delegates. When they do that, then boom, he doesn't even have it in the convention. They're going to do something along that line, because they're not going to provide him. The only thing on his favor is an overwhelming support at the convention, and maybe there might be a powerful movement around the convention center in certain ways that might compel, you could say, the leadership to go along with the nomination of Donald Trump. But I see they're continuing to push towards an open or brokered convention, and in doing that, they're going to open it up to gain an advantage over Trump. Ted Cruz has problems with he's gaining. He's a sharp politician. He has he's very brilliant orator and debater. But the only problem with him is he's got Heidi, his wife, that's got connections to the Fed, to Goldman Sachs, and to these trade organizations through George W. Bush's administration. There's too many problems there. They used to label themselves early on as a Bush marriage, you know, in Houston. So they're tied to the Bush and to the oil and to the Bush cartel down there, the power, you know, cartel, you could say. So they're not going to be free and independent like we might want them to be as Trump. Trump, on the other hand, continues to have these personality things of his ego. He strikes back. He riles. He attacks. He counterattacks. On that initial debate that they had with Kelly out there, Megyn Kelly, he should have said something. I would have, if I had been Trump, I would say, "Well, Kelly, I would have expected a much more professional question coming from you instead of something like this that is personally demeaning to myself." Something like that, it would have completely knocked her off balance, but in a nice way. Trump needs to develop more diplomacy. He needs to become more presidential, and he needs to get off of this ego crap that he falls into. He's too egotistical. He's too self-centered. It's demeaning to himself, and it subtracts away from what he's trying to do. He dwells on very, very important subjects and issues of our day, and we need to get him. He needs to get back on that, away from this personal ego thing that he always falls back into. He always gets resentful, and then he starts attacking. And the public at large does not like that. There's a certain amount of number of people that have followed him over the years with television and his television program. So any personality, any television personality, gains a certain following over a number of years. See, so that's not uncommon to have a following. Now that's a following. Now what he's added to that is a very riled up, very hateful, in some cases resentful, but in other cases rightfully upset about the country. So he has a rebellion, a very rebellious America out there. There are many people in America that are in rebellion, and they're the silent majority most of the time, and they're beginning to be vocal now, and they are supporting Trump because on major issues he's right. On many issues like the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement and the Fed and things like that. So he's very attractive on certain major things. Recently at AIPAC, he went there, and that's a very powerful organization, and it's part of the Zionist Israeli power bloc, and they dominate much of Congress. And so he went there and spoke. I think the only person that did not go was Bernie Sanders. So that was something, and he is Jewish himself, but he would not go to AIPAC. I remember back when Ron Paul was running for office, they wouldn't even invite Ron Paul, because Ron Paul would stand up against those people. He was not someone that could be intimidated by that group. So they never invited him to those meetings to speak or anything else, because they knew his position on Israel. My own position is that there are good people in Israel that we need to support. But just like any powerful political government group, there are those in Israel that are willing and dealing, along with ones here that are willing and dealing, and both are willing and dealing for their own interests, but not for the real interest of Israel or for the real interest of America. And so we're both losers, the both citizens of Israel and the citizens of America that want to do the right thing are losing to these very powerful individuals that are heads in many cases and tied into all the transnational corporations and so forth and so forth. We have things developing in this country. Todd Fletcher was a friend of mine before he passed away. And he was a producer of guns and butter on the West Coast. We had what's happening in this country today with all these shootings and so forth. Todd and I talked about that several times on my program. And in fact, Dr. Gantzer, Daniel Gantzer, out of Switzerland, wrote a book called NATO's Secret Army. And it was about the Gladio operations in the NATO countries in Western Europe. And basically what that was about was that after World War II, NATO was formed, and they created these left behind, these stay behind groups in the Eastern Bloc, okay, countries that the Soviets were occupying, and they were going to be groups that could create rebellion and revolution in those countries and bring those countries to the West. Eventually, that never happened. But as a side issue, or something that fell out of this left behind group, was what they call the Gladio operations. And the Gladio was a name picked up in Italy, meaning sword. And that's where some of the first exposés of what was happening in the Gladio operations occurred. The NATO groups were running black operations through their intelligence operations, special operations groups, and they were tensioning those countries that they were operating in. In Italy, they were going out and doing terrorist acts and bombings and so forth and blaming them on the Red Brigade. And then the public would see all of this terrorism, and they would be much more easy and more pliable under this tension situation to go along with more centralized government management. And that's basically what many of the terrorist organizations and operations occurred throughout Europe. So Todd Fletcher, before he passed away, we were talking, and we've got a similar dynamic happening in this country. We've got these shootings occurring, and they seem to be at random sometimes, and they're individuals and they're deranged or whatever and so forth, but they're acting effectively to induce into the American public and scare attention. It acts in ways to push gun control systems. They act in a way to increase police actions and to give more impetus to more combat type of police actions. So we've seen the police being armed more and more with very deadly weapon systems and armor and things like this for combat and riot type gear. And we've seen these SWAT teams. A number of years ago, I was broadcasting at a restaurant, a remote live broadcast, and there happened to be an incident that occurred in behind the restaurant that I was at, and I was live on the air at the time. I just started a two-hour broadcast. Before I knew it, there were 40 SWAT teams, members that surrounded the restaurant and put up all kinds of the yellow ribbons, you know. And I was inside that cordoned-off area broadcasting. And Bob Chapman is who I was talking to at the time. And he was a fine person, Bob Chapman was. He's gone now. But Bob had a great insight into economics and Wall Street and gold and so forth. Bob had come out of the Army Security Agency in the Castle area about 10 years before I did my 3-year service in the Army Security Agency. So we had that in common. And Bob was just a fine person. He finally did pass away. He was broadcasting out of Mexico at one time and on the internet. And he was quite a guest to have on. His insight was very keen. He never put forward any types of opinions that were not well thought out and so forth. And anyway, But he knew about all of this Gladio. He knew about all these tension things and all these economics things and so forth. But Todd Fletcher, getting back to Todd Fletcher, is that he was a producer of Guns and Butter on the West Coast. And Todd Fletcher and I talked several times about these kinds of dynamics occurring. And what was really going on, and we believe that there was an American Gladio operation that was being operated. There could be some individuals went out on their own and did shootings, and then some could have been government run and government operations. And so this San Bernardino thing, it looks like that they set the two victims up out there in the street. There's problems with many of these things that are going on today. So we're being tensioned in the country, and the government is tensioning the public, and they're corralling them and move them towards more of a gun control, an anti, you could say, weapons of, you know, these combat type weapons or whatever, and control of magazines and smaller magazines, and all these killings are going on. We've got to do something, and the liberal Democrats are just right there in the middle of it. And many of your, some of your churches today are also have fallen a victim to some of these things. Well, anyway, we've got a click off there on Dr. Daniel Ganser out of Switzerland with a book that he wrote, NATO Secret Army, and he was talking about the Gladio operations in Europe. And like I told you, Todd Fletcher and I have covered this in the past, and we even have a YouTube up also. There's a click off of a YouTube on Ganser, so don't miss looking at that. It's a short one, but it's awful good. He's also has very insight into 9/11. Ganser does. Okay, now what's building up in this country, though, is that you can look at 9/11, you can say, was it an inside job? Who did it? But the outcome of it is that we went over, we used it to attack Afghanistan. We used it to attack Iraq. We used it to go into Libya. We used it to go into Syria. We've used it against this radical jihadist type group. But did we not then, was that not created by us? If 9/11 was created by us, then this whole thing has been created by our own endeavors, our own deep, dark operations. And that's basically what I feel has happened. Whatever you, however you come out, we did attack these foreign countries. They were Islamic. They came back with all this fighting, and so it's proven now that we're supporting ISIS in several ways and so forth. So it's a total mess, and Hillary has been right in the middle of these things, especially the Libya thing and the Syrian thing. So I just can't understand people that would support her stance, and it's because she's a woman, so she's going to play that card that she's a woman, and that she needs to be, there needs to be a woman in the White House, and la-da-da-da. And then the last thing was we had to have a black man in the White House, see? So we got to vote for Obama, see? So the latest play, I guess, is that we've got to have a woman in there. Now, I'm not against having a woman in the White House, but not this one, not Hillary. I mean, she's got big problems, but the Democrats that are supporting them have no idea of what she really stands for. Not really. We've had these in Brussels recently. We've had these bombings within the airport there. Now that's going to damage. We're beginning to start at a spring, summer, fall tourist season. Now, what is that going to do to the tourism in Belgium or in Europe? See, people are going to start canceling some of their trips because they don't want to be caught up in other bombings that might occur. And so this is probably some of the jihadist takes in trying to take down Europe. The reason why is there so many, you could say, refugees in Europe? Why did that happen? See, that happened because the people that control that UN and things like this and these refugee camps and control those major politicos like Merkel in Germany have allowed it to occur. So are they allowing it to occur to create a new Europe? Are they to rewrite a new Europe? Are they creating it to create chaos within those countries, which they have done? But it's pushing the average person to the right. And many of the right wing, you could say, or the very conservative parties in those countries are gaining membership. And so this immigration thing is backfiring on the leftists or the left liberals in those European Union countries. The agreement that the European countries had was that there was like free movement. See, if you're a part of the European Union, you had to allow free movement within those European nations, those countries. And so they did away with with border controls and so forth. And that's basically what these refugees are playing on. They're jumping on, you know, all kinds of ships and everything else to get into England or whatever they can do to get there, you know, and trains, the Chanel and all that. These terrorists, now that they have been created for one reason or another, you could say, are becoming dangerous. There was evidence in Brussels in Belgium that some of these terrorists were putting together a dirty bomb. Those things are going to be very dangerous to us. They can take a large area and make it uninhabitable for a long time. One of the most dangerous things that I've been monitoring over the last few months has been that our nuclear plants are not that well guarded in this country. They have a minimum of security. So if these jihadists mounted some serious attacks on some of our nuclear plants, they could possibly shut down the cooling apparatuses of those plants. If they shut down the cooling apparatuses of some of these plants, then we're in big problems, because they could go into meltdown situations, and in meltdown situations we could go into major. If you take, like in the ponds, the storage ponds of many of these nuclear reactors, power generators, if you take the water out of there, you're going to go into and start an incendiary fire, and it's going to get radioactive stuff into the air. We've got that problem. We've got the electromagnetic pulse. Finally, some Christian guys over here, the guy that used to own Curves, is producing a new movie now, and it's about not Armageddon. What was it called? I'll think of it here in a second. But it's a catchy name. But he's producing a movie about electromagnetic pulse attack against America. See, and that is real. I way back when Ron Paul was running for president, I proposed through his campaign director at the time, was to put forward some kind of a plan our power system throughout the country is tied together with large transformers, if these transformers are if they're breached, okay, by an electromagnetic pulse weapon, and the electromagnetic pulse weapons put out a high radiation that induces in two electrical devices a current that burns them up. That's the way it works. So if a big bomb up high enough and strong enough knocked out many of our transformers, will our power system be gone? And everything in America runs on power, right? So it would throw us into a catastrophic situation that we may not ever begin to recover for years. The backup transformers are not there. It takes 2 or 3 years to even build some of these transformers. So I made a proposal to Ron Paul years ago that he ought to start putting that on the table in Congress when he was still in Congress. And it was an important issue to broach with his fellow congressional members. Today is still something important we've got to put forward, and it's gaining. There's knowledge of this now that's beginning to gain, and I think it possibly might be done sooner or later, you know. But that is very, very paramount in my own mind about what we should be doing. The country, okay, as a whole, okay, is in a deluded state. I wrote a book recently called Be Good to Yourself. And in that book, I put forward an idea, a very simple idea. And basically the idea is that at birth, I believe that we are experiencing by degree now, not everyone, you know, totally here we're talking about, but by degree, okay? I believe that an MPD dynamic occurs. And what I mean by that is multiple personality disorder. And what that means is that there's a there's a dynamic that can split off from your core real personality or self, another personality or another self. But I believe that that occurs in everyone almost. And then there's this ego self, this false self that I guess we begin to relate to. And I believe that that's the way it happens. But we don't see that this is going on. And we're just sort of caught up in this total dynamic, see. So we grow up. We're nurtured up into adulthood. We're conditioned through education, our parents, their religion, their political ideas. We get into colleges. We might get exposed to a little bit different ideas there and so forth. But it's stratified. It's systematically compartmentalized. The education system is like going and jumping in a big box, you could say, and then looking at other boxes on the campus where the other disciplines are taught, you know. In other words, you go out to a campus, you walk around the campus, you see all these different departments. Well, it's compartmentalized then, see. You need crosstalk. You need a wide view of things. And at the universities and so forth, you're not going to get that. And in particular today, a gentleman that I just talked to earlier this afternoon, we were talking about, you know, micro transgressions, aggressions, and things like that, that part of this political correctness thing. There's something that somebody wrote Trump on it with chalk on a sidewalk, and they went ballistic on it. The rallies that Trump is having now are beginning to attract a lot more troublemakers, and they're trying to create incidents at his many of his events. In Nazi Germany, in pre-Nazi Germany, you had, after World War I, the Weimar Republic was created in 1918. And it lasted for about 15 years till 1933, until Hitler consolidated his power. The Weimar Republic started off very well because of the reparations that Germany had to pay, and especially some of the control mechanisms, the international borders and so forth. Germany suffered greatly after World War I. That's why it had economic problems and high unemployment, and then it had a hyperinflation also. But during that Weimar Republic, they had a very good constitution and so forth. But during this period, as the economic problems increased, you had rioting begin to occur, and you had groups out there that began to vie for power. And the Nazis and other groups were groups that began to struggle in the streets. They had street fights and so forth. And so you had a lot of groups there, and there were some leftover people from World War I also that had a large group. You had military groups, individuals dressed up with military attire fighting each other. But what came out of that was a consolidation of the Nazi Party. The Nazi Party started gaining more support. And they consolidated a greater number in their parliament, their Reichstag. And they became a real force within the Reichstag. And then that gave rise to Hitler. Hindenburg became ill and then appointed Hitler as chancellor. And from then on, the Reichstag fire was set up by them. And from that, after the Enabling Act, took away all of the rights of the Germans. We're seeing a period now, and I think Peikoff, who was a successor to Ayn Rand, set it out best in the Ominous Parallels. And I'm going to give a click-off. There'll be a click-off on this site about that. But Ominous Parallels, set out the parallels of pre-Nazi Germany with America today. We're seeing more division and divisiveness occur, and especially this Trump thing, and the Hillary thing, and those people that supported of all those of both of those candidates. I'm beginning to see a much more dangerous situation develop, much like pre-Nazi Germany during the Weimar, at the end, towards the end of the Weimar Republic, you say. And so it's troubling to me, and it saddens me, because I see an America that's breaking up right in front of my eyes, and I talk about it, and I try to interest people in trying to save the country, but you've got people that would rather do Little League than look at some of the material that they need to see. It's just frustrating, but we've got to continue on and do what we need to do. The world, the struggle for man is not so much as trying to make people do what you want, but what it is, it's more of a struggle of doing what you need to do. See, I think Paul, in his writings in the Bible, says that I do the things I should not do, and I should do the things I should do, but he never did the things he should do. See, that's early on, and he's already doing the things that he should do, see. So we've got to start doing the things that we should do to come out of the delusion. Now, when I said that this delusion is created, this multiple personality disorder, I believe is created shortly after birth. It's beginning to be created, see. It takes a while to develop this. And then that personality created, you could call the ego self or the false self. And I think that it's driven by worldly dynamics. Through the parents, see? The parents, not that they're bad parents, and I'm not saying that they're bad parents here, but good parents are suffering from worldly problems and worldly dynamics themselves. So they are inducing and raising the child a worldly type of system, see? And so I believe that the child grows up with this separation from the real core self, real self, and from the conscience self, or the state of consciousness is what I call it. I've come up in my book with the state of consciousness, which would be physical, and the state of consciousness, which would be psychological, spiritual, and so forth. So I believe that we're separated at an early age from that. So what occurs is this personality that who we think we are, but it's not our core real self. And I believe to get back to that real core self and to integrate back to and to reestablish a conscience-based psychological, spiritual self, I believe that we need to forgive ourselves and others. So what I say in the book is that we must begin to forgive ourselves and others. And when you begin to walk in the spirit of forgiving like this, I think you're doing two things. You're integrating two things. You know, there's this continual battle out there between the people, the faith-based religious, churches, and the works-based, see. And the faith-based said, you got to have faith, you don't need the works. And the works people say, well, you got to have the works and not necessarily the faith, but we have faith too, maybe, you know. But basically, when you begin to walk in the spirit of forgiveness, I believe you can integrate both of those things together. And I think an integration of those things together is what we must try to experience and then regain. What happens then? I believe as you begin to forgive yourself and others and really awaken you begin to see yourself better, so you know yourself better. So, but also it begins to dissolve the false self. And as you dissolve the false self, there's a homecoming, like a geese flying back to their summer nesting, you know, in Canada. You begin to come back to the real core self, see? And that real core self is conscience-based. So if you look at this as a spectrum, on one end, hopefully you'll come back and regain the real self and that conscience-based self and so forth. On the other end are your psychopaths that are totally worldly-driven, totally, you could say, programmed into this whole thing, have no conscience at all, and are destroying through wars and whatever and power mongering the world. See, so that's basically the two extremes. See, that I'm setting out in the book. See, but so we're continually though cultivated and recruited to this worldly thing through the press and television and the writing, see, because to maintain power, the elitists have to continue the divisiveness of the world, the divisions that exist. They work through divisions and not. If we really come together, then we stand strong together. See, a house divided will fall. See, and that's what we're living in, fallen housing, you could say. But basically, we have homes today that are broken. We have homes that are divided. We've got to come back, consolidate, and fix this, and get families back together again, and so forth. But the when you do acquire this, there's a peace and tranquility. We're talking about real enlightenment here. We're not talking about some fictionalized coaching thing here. When I wrote this book, it's not a. If you want a book on coaching, go get Be Good to you know, The Power of Positive Thinking or something. This is not a coaching book. Okay, what I have set out in Be Good to Yourself is a book that I believe that can make a difference. See, a real difference. Because whoever psychologist or psychiatrist you're going to, or whatever, if you put into this whole mix a forgiveness dosage of good medicine, that will bring you out of that fixated delusional state. The delusion, see, is trickery, see. In other words, the people that control delude us, and in deluding us, they're tricking us into thinking certain ways about the world, about worldviews, about politics. They continue to hit us with all these mainline press and broadcasts, see, all these big television stations and all this big television systems and so forth. But they continue to create a system of thought that is controlling and not freeing. If they truly wanted to free us, then they would not, you could say, control their writers and their broadcasters like they do. And it's getting worse. There's more limits on what they can say, and there's more narrow, you know, and especially this Trump thing. They write totally against him and very biased. And you can see that the public is waking up to some of this, see. And they're beginning to say, hey, you're not fair on this, and you're no so forth and so on. But there's points there where the press is obviously and becoming so transparent that they're not fair, and they're really putting out propaganda instead of journalism. In other words, real journalists are more fair-minded, but they might write from – everyone writes from a viewpoint. Let's face it. As any writer, you're going to have, and I've experienced this myself. When I sit down to write some serious piece, there's some bias there. There's something I want to say, but I can't ignore obvious evidence on the other side either. But I have to cite that evidence, and then I have to explain why I do not agree, say, with that evidence or whatever. If that's the case, there might be. I've started out on some article before where I've changed my mind about before I finished the article. Like, my gosh, I was too harsh here. There have been situations where I didn't write an article. See, I'd start out wanting to write an article, and then I'd end up saying, "Oh my gosh, I'm on the wrong side of this thing." See, or you know, or what, or the you know the idea I had, or the bias that I had, and people have biases. Was not fair. Was not fair-minded. See, it did not give enough, you know, credence to the argument across the aisle there, so to speak. So you live and you learn, and what I did in this book is that if we could use this, and forgiveness is a tool. It's a tool of freedom. It is not a tool of control. That's the beauty of it. See. When you give that gift to people and they begin to start forgiving themselves and others, they become free from this system, see? And that's really where the attack, I believe, on, you're talking about the attack on Jesus or Christianity or anything like that from the left or from whoever. I believe that attack is more on this teaching of forgiveness than anything else. because I believe that's the most powerful lesson I believe that he was preaching when he walked the earth, see. Because because forgiveness equals freedom, see. And it also is a cult breaker, see. That's the way I describe it, is that when you begin to see yourself and you see that you've been caught up with groups and become members of groups, then you begin to step outside and leave those groups because you begin to see that the group is controlling and trying to use you and get money from you. And it's all about money a lot of times, and control and your adoration and your worship of that leader. The leaders always have a guru there that is the master. Yeah, they always have a master, someone that knows all the answers, see, that any group member or any member of the group could ask him, right? But forgiveness breaks you out, and it's a cult breaker. And that's why it's feared, see, that these teachings are not well received by the elitists because they don't want this. They don't want something this simple out there. In other words, guy comes along and like Jesus and says, hey, he who is without sin, cast the, you know what I mean, the first stone. And the men were about to stone this woman for her sins. And they looked at each other and said, my gosh, none of us can cast a stone because none of us are without sin. I'm getting a little preachy here, and I don't mean to get, but the New Testament was about the new way, see. And that's really what it's about. The new way about forgiveness and coming out of that delusion, see. When you come out of the delusion, then you become free, see. And it's about real freedom, see. You know, it's not about I voted and I'm free and I'm going to vote for this guy and he's going to. But we can't put our faith in anyone, and that's whether it's Trump or Bush or Obama or Hillary or anybody out there. You cannot place your faith in another human being because they will not come through for you because they have failings. They have human nature to undermine some of their efforts. But you have to work within the system. I know there are certain churches that that don't participate at all in politics, and I don't agree with that. We have to act. We have to participate, and we can participate more on the local level than any other level that we can hope to. So if we go out there and we start electing our local people, we know who they are. We go in, put our money behind them, go out with signs, knock on doors, or whatever you want to do to campaign for those people. Get them elected. Try to monitor them. Get them to pass the right things or not to pass the right things, and to say no to bad legislation or bad proposals. And try to get our economic house in order. See, that everyone's just totally out of control with spending. See, so if we can do that and try to be good citizens and be good parents. Be good moms and dads for our children and examples. And the thing is, when a child sees that you're forgiving in certain situations, how life-changing is that? That is overwhelmingly powerful. It's powerful in any rehabilitation work that any social worker could, whether they believe in God or not, it doesn't matter. The forgiveness is powerful. It benefits the atheist as much as it does the Bible-thumping fanatic. It benefits all of us, and it is about freedom. I want to thank you for listening tonight to this. I went off a little bit on that. Got a little preachy, I know, but there's no other way to say it sometimes but the way that I said it. But I want to thank each and every one of you for listening, and I want to bless every one of you out there. And come back next Saturday night, 7 to 9. This program, this first hour, will be followed by a rebroadcast of a very important subject. So keep listening to our second hour. And thank you so very much for listening. And God bless each and every one of you out there. And let's get it together. Let's save this country. Let's put America back in order. Thank you for listening. Good night.